Hi, this is Danielle from The Jealous Curator, and this is episode 27 of Art for Your Ear. Thanks as always to Saatchi Art for supporting this episode. They are the world's largest curated online gallery, offering original art by independent artists from around the world. And by the way, if you use Jealous Curator at checkout, you'll get 10% off. Just saying. So today I'm talking to Sydney Pink. He is very smart, very talented, and not really named Sydney Pink. Are you intrigued? Okay, let's get on with this and call him in Baltimore. Hi, Sydney.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great.
How's the weather in Baltimore?
It's a surprisingly warm fall.
Oh, that's nice. Actually, I was just in New York a few weeks ago, and I was so hot. I didn't even wear a coat in November in New York. Okay, so there are so many things to ask you. I want to talk to you about your work. And I discovered you years ago when you were doing all sorts of drawings of Japanese girls and astronauts and businessmen.
Yeah.
Are you still doing those?
Sort of. I am, yeah. That's been a part of my work for the last 8 to 10 years, and is very central to a lot of what I've done. But that was really born out of a time when I was living in Japan.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I found you years ago and thought, he must live in Japan, or it did for a little while anyway. They are so fantastic. So I'm glad to hear that you're still doing them. So let's just go back a little bit. I just want to hear about your schooling. Like, do you have a BFA? Did you go to school for illustration? Because your work is very illustrative. So what's your background?
Well, I studied at MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore, Maryland, and I did get my BFA in general fine arts, which just meant like painting and drawing. And mostly what I did was painting and drawing, although I studied all sorts of different ways of working and, you know, basic sculpture and stuff. But my training really wasn't illustrative. I think that came more out of a period of time after college where I maybe wasn't working as much, but then started to find my own voice as an artist. And, you know, I'm very attracted to work that has an implied narrative or that there's a sense that there's a story behind it. Plus, I was really inspired by artists I was looking at the time, like Marcel Dezama and Aya Takano.
Mm. And so were you in Japan at that time?
When that work started, yeah, I was coming out of a very long, I say dry spell. I mean, I was making work, but it was in a different way. It was just little projects, little things here and there. But there was this moment, and this was probably about 5 or 6 years after my undergrad work, when I found that I was going to museums or galleries or different art spaces. And this was over many months or years. And I kept finding myself being attracted to certain types of work. And what I realized, it was work with a lot of white space or a lot of negative space. And at first, I found myself dismissing this as sort of not even really seeing it or acknowledging it. But more and more, I started to find myself thinking about that type of work. And there was this moment when a light bulb sort of went off when I said, oh, like, I could be making work like this. Like, I can do that. That's a choice.
Which instead of just appreciating
simple,
it.
But it really was this huge moment of, oh, if that's the kind of work I like, then that's what I should do.
So was your undergrad work?
I immediately just was off and running and just couldn't stop making work.
Yeah, your portfolio from that time is so packed. There's so much stuff and it's all so weird and amazing and narrative and beautifully done. And so was your undergrad work then, like, did you fill every white space? Like, how different was it to those pieces?
Well, undergrad was in a lot of ways just learning basic art skills and technique. Mm-hmm. And there was a push to find your voice as an artist, even as an undergrad. You know, I remember in my junior and senior year classes and independent work being like, find your voice and find your niche. And I tried to some extent, but if anything, I wish I could go back to that younger self and say, just make work. Like, don't worry about it being some style or your voice. Because I do really think part of being an artist is living life and experiencing things. And I don't think I ever would have gotten to that light bulb moment had I not been, yes, continuing to make work, but also just living life.
Mm-hmm. And it's just so, that is such great advice, actually, though, just pay attention to the things that you like. Because obviously you're drawn to certain things for a certain reason, so embrace that.
Exactly.
So you were off to the races, you'd sort of found this style, and you were just making. And I think I can't remember if I asked you this in Creative Block or if we talked about it when we met in New York. How do you, like, do those narratives actually mean something, or do you pull out random images and put them together and it creates a narrative, or how does that come together?
Well, it's very intuitive, and I have a lot of people ask me, like, what does it mean?
Yeah.
You know, part of me wants to say, like, figure, you know, what does it mean to you, which can be frustrating for some people, but it's true that there is an element of mystery that I want to be there in terms of a viewer not just figuring out what's happening in one piece, but also I think my work does have an accumulative effect in the sense that when you start to look at several pieces or a whole exhibition of works, they start to play off each other and you start to see recurring characters. And it definitely poses the question of, well, here this character is doing this and over there they're doing that. So, you know, naturally a viewer is going to try to make links and figure out what's happening. But quite honestly, for me, I don't have a story planned out. It is very intuitive. It's a lot of just thinking about a posture that I want a figure to be in, or an element of, or just thinking of it sort of like a designer would in terms of where I want certain forms or colors. Mm. But a lot of it, I think, is also influenced maybe on a more sort of unconscious level, but in terms of the own thing. Things I'm looking at, things that inspire me. I'm a huge fan of pop culture, and my wife and I are huge science fiction fans. Everything from like cheesy B movies to, I mean, right now we're watching Space 99, which is this great, I say cheesy, but it was actually had pretty cool production values, like sci-fi show from the 70s.
Oh, that's cool.
So I'm sure those things like seep in.
Well, like laser guns and astronauts and stuff.
Yeah.
I love them. I think one of my favorite ones is the two girls with the tiger masks.
Yeah.
I love that piece. What, why did you see a tiger mask?
You know, honestly, I was working as an assistant to a preschool teacher that year. It was while we were living in Japan, but I was working in a preschool and we had all these animal masks. And I just remember finding the bag of it and thinking like, oh, this would make a really great drawing. Now, the thing I will say about this body of work we're talking about is something that I don't often mention. Don't tell anyone.
Okay. Just between you and me.
Is I was in this phase of like wanting to do these scenes, and I couldn't really quite figure out how to do it as an artist because I knew I didn't have the ability to draw just out of my head. Mm-hmm. And I do really respect that. But I think most artists, or many artists, do need some kind of reference material. And so for me, I knew I wanted to create these scenes, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. And then I had, this was like another light bulb moment. This was like just after my other light bulb moment. Was I said to myself, I could just take reference photos of myself to use for my drawings. And this was at a time when digital photography was relatively new. So even that in and of itself, I mean, I remember doing reference drawings on film in college, which I'm sure some listeners remember and others may have not experienced that. But I remember having to take the film and get it developed. And you could get it developed in an hour, which was so quick. Mm-hmm. And then you could have real live photos in front of you. But later on when I had this light bulb, I could take reference photos. Digital photography was pretty new and I had a laptop. And so I was doing a lot of posing of myself in these costumes and things
Oh my God.
In my room, in my, well, it was like my, you know, bedroom slash studio. So there was sort of this whole, I don't know if performance is the right word, but there was this whole aspect to the process of also sort of improvising in real time with props and costumes and taking these photos. And so in a weird way, I guess my stuff is sort of like a self-portrait.
Wow, that is so cool. I did not know that. That's, you don't happen to have any of those photos, do you?
I'm sure they're somewhere.
They all burned in a fire. Oh no, wait, they're digital. Well, if you happen to find any that could work its way into the post that goes with this episode,
we could find something.
We could pop some in, but no pressure.
Yeah, and you know, they're not finished. They were never intended to be a finished piece, but they very much are evidence of the process.
Yeah, which is so cool. I mean, you know, I did not know that, and that, what a cool tidbit when you're actually looking at the work to know that. And a great, again, more advice for people to do that, because I know there is a lot of tricky stuff around reference material, right? Like if you base a piece on an existing photograph, that you can get in trouble for, you know, referencing that photograph. So take photographs of yourself. Can't get in trouble for that.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, I would highly encourage people to do life drawing, and I've actually been doing even some more life drawing myself recently. But at the same time, we're at a place with art where there really are no rules. So, you know, if somebody's saying, oh, you can't do this, or you can't use photos, or you should be drawing for life, like, all those rules are just made up.
Yeah.
You know? At the end of the day, somebody has to figure out the right process for them and the way they're going to make their art.
Yeah. Speaking of making your art, you are doing your MFA.
Yes. Right? So I did my BFA here in Baltimore, and then I moved to Japan for 4 years, and now I'm back. And I can't believe it. I think it's been almost 8 years that I've been back in Baltimore. So I say back, but
yeah, back 8 years ago.
But I'm here in Baltimore, and I've been working on my MFA at Towson University part-time. But what's interesting is I'm also working in a full-time staff position at Towson University as a staff member in the Department of Dance. And I've been there the last 5 years. And so while I've been working on my MFA, I'm also doing this other work, which has primarily been administrative, and to some extent it's been my day job, or that's one way you could think of it, you know, to pay the bills. But beyond that, I've been exposed to, and I've been part of the performing arts world in many different capacities at different times in my life. And I actually took dance when I was younger.
I read that on your bio page.
Yeah.
Which is so I had no idea about that.
So about 5 years ago, 4.5 years ago, I got my head together with a dancer that I'd met at Towson, and we wanted to do some kind of arts festival. And so we conceived this thing called Akimbo, which became a festival of site-specific dance and movement-based art, but with a very interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary approach that we have visual artists, musicians, all kinds of artists, and including dancers and performance artists that come together and create these site-specific works. And we usually have somewhere between 15 or 20 artists that perform each year. And my role in that festival has primarily been one as an organizer and helping to run the event. But what I started to find was that by being a part of this event, I was ending up at the workshops and moving myself and working with great people like Liz Lerman has done some workshops for us, and she's a great artist. She's created the critical response process, which is a way to give feedback about art. Every artist should look that up.
You were telling me about that, and it sounded so interesting because you know all of my terrible crit stories, and I think that's how we ended up chatting about that one time. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so Liz Lerman created Dance Exchange near D.C. Here in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I don't remember exactly when she started it, but I think it was maybe like in the 70s or early 80s. And she immediately wanted to create a multi-generational dance company, which she did. And still to this day, the company has dancers that are a wide range of ages and backgrounds from like 18 to 80. But one of the things that she discovered in creating work was that she would have these feedback sessions or critiques with professionals. And she found that she would leave those conversations absolutely devastated and deflated and not interested in making work in art at all. And so she said, there's got to be a better way to do this. And so after many years, she developed the critical response process, which is a way for artists that, as she says it, are making anything from a cake to a dance, mm-hmm. Or a piece of visual art or film or theater or anything, can get feedback from their peers and colleagues. And I've used it in several different settings, both with dance and visual art, and I find it to be highly effective. I think the main thing that makes it work is that it puts the artist and where the artist is at the center of the process. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about and definitely was encouraged by Liz to think about is when you're giving an artist feedback, it's not making them what you want them to be, but making them the best they can be, and especially making them the best they can be from where they're at that moment. Yeah, it's so simple, but that simple shift in thinking, because I think even someone with the best of intention can go into a critique and let their own ego sort of drive the conversation.
Mm-hmm. I know, and you really have to, yeah, exactly that. Consider the person and where they are, you know, in their work and all of that stuff. Are there links that I can put for people to read more about this if they want to?
Yeah, there's a lot of information on Liz's website and on the Dance Exchange website, and I can share those.
Okay, great. I'll put them in the post, and then people can read more about that if they want to. So let's talk about your MFA, because you and I chatted a while ago about something that we're going to get to in a minute. And you were saying that with your MFA, because I said, oh, you know, are you continuing with your, you know, with your drawings? And you said, no, actually, I've been trying all sorts of different stuff. And I kind of love that. Like, you know, I've heard from so many people that an MFA is really a place to explore and, you know, tried things you haven't tried. So what are you trying?
Well, one thing I wanted to do, and I had it in the back of my mind, was do like a big, giant, colorful oil painting, which is like the sort of exact opposite of what I had been doing.
And how did that go?
It didn't go good. But, you know, I think the lesson there was a couple of things. One, I'm really glad I did it because I have no regrets. There's mm-hmm. not that nagging voice in the back of my head that's saying, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. Because I can say, I did it, I tried it, and that's not for me.
Yeah.
But I think it was also a lesson, which I think every artist deals with over and over again, is being influenced by outside forces, whatever's trendy or whatever might be marketable or what you think you'd be able to sell. You know, I'm sure like installation artists or performance artists deal with this all the time. Somebody's saying, why don't you make a painting? Because it'll sell.
Yeah.
But for every artist, it's always coming back to yourself. And one of my faculty members used the word allurements. What are your allurements? What is alluring to you? What are you fascinated by? What are you charmed by? What are you pulled towards? What's that thing in your gut and your heart that says you should be doing this? And that was that light bulb moment I had back when I realized my love of negative and white space. And so in a way, there was a moment when I was questioning that. And I think it's good that I tested that questioning, but then realized again that I have to go back to myself. I have to go back to what's true to me as an artist. And it sounds grand, but it really can be very simple things like what are the materials you're using or what's the imagery you love or what's the scale you like to work at. I mean, that's one of the funny things about academics is often what you'll get in a critique is they'll just tell you the opposite of what you're doing. If you work small, they'll tell you, you should work big. If you work big, they'll say, you should work small. And I think it's good to test and try those things. because sometimes being pushed by someone has led me in new directions. I'm not saying that one shouldn't push themselves to change and grow, but at the same time, it's always being attuned to. Another way to think about it is like that North Star, that point of light, that thing that is always leading you forward. And sometimes we can't even articulate what that North Star is for us, but it's always the thing that guides us forward, that moves us to the next piece, to the next painting, to the next work.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I've talked about this a little bit on this podcast, but in other places too, about, you know, being told by that prof that I should never paint again. And so I didn't. And just recently, you know, I thought, well, it's been 20 years and he doesn't own me. So I was like, I'm going to paint again. So I tried. It was sort of like your oil painting. I was just like, oh, I didn't enjoy myself. I forced myself to do it for about 2 weeks. Every day went into the studio to paint. And the whole time I was in there, I just kept thinking, God, I wish I was doing collage. Like, I just wish I had my big bowl of stuff I want to cut out. And I just kept looking over at it thinking, I wish I was cutting that stuff out instead. But no, I'm going to be a painter. And then after a couple of weeks, I was like, screw this. Like, I'm just going to cut stuff out. It brings me so much joy. I love the final pieces. And it's like, I was trying to, it was very square peg round hole. And I was like, why? You know, and it's exactly what you said. It's just like paying attention to those allurements, to those things that, like, you know, especially when you have, like, I have a kid and a job and all these things, that my art time is very, it's very few and far between those hours, you know, and when I have those hours, why on earth would I spend them doing something I hate?
Yeah.
So I kind of have had a few light bulb moments too. And that's a huge one. So it's interesting that, you know, your big oil painting kind of led you back to your, you know, to yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, Sydney. Okay, so this was really interesting. This is why we talked the other day. It's probably a couple of months ago now. So this is so cool. What you are teaching and what you are researching right now, I think, is so important in the, you know, academic art world. Can you tell everybody what you're doing?
So I mentioned earlier that I've been working at Towson University as a staff member, and that's where I'm working on my MFA. But I've also had the opportunity to start to teach. And I knew that I wanted to work with undergrad students from a variety of arts disciplines, whether it be from dance, theater, film, art. I wanted to bring students from a variety of those disciplines together in a room. And I knew I wanted them to do something around the topic of business or starting their art careers or just the practical questions, the nuts and bolts of how you make this happen. I didn't know what it was called, but when I spoke to the dean of the college and proposed a class, I said, basically, I want to tell students about what I wish someone had told me. What do I wish someone had told me while I was a student? And I started reading and doing some research and realized that there were a lot of educators across the nation and the world that are thinking about this. And many of them are calling it arts entrepreneurship. And there's a lot of debate around that title and those words and if artists can even be entrepreneurs. But I dove into that world and have started to do that work. And part of that has been building a relationship with the Society of Arts Entrepreneurship Educators. And the whole group is looking more at how do we teach these things that a lot of artists talk about, how to market yourself, how do you build a sustainable life day to day to where you're making the work you want to, but you can also pay the bills.
I hear that come up over and over and over with so many artists.
Yeah.
Even so, like doing your taxes and, like, you know, basically being a small business.
Exactly.
What goes with that? You know, when I was about to graduate, I said, you know, what do we do when we graduate? And my main prof said, grad school. And I was like, anything else? And he was like, nope. I was just like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And, you know, I wish exactly what you said. I wish somebody had taught me that stuff at school.
And I think the reason a lot of people in higher education are anxious to talk about this is because there are genuine concerns about what sorts of careers might look like for students that study, say, painting or acting. You know, I think there are valid questions. But at the same time, I think people that love art and do art deeply know that this is important to our society, mm-hmm. and that we need people studying and being artists. And so how do we connect the realities of being an artist with the ideal of that we want to have people out making art and thinking critically about the world and connect all of these things in a way that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And so right now, how many do you know, because I know you've been doing a lot of research, generally speaking, do art schools have programs like this, or is it sort of hit and miss, or because you're teaching one?
There's surprisingly a lot. And if you go to the Society of Arts Entrepreneurship Educators website, they do have a database with all the programs, everything from minors and majors to one-off classes. That said, there's not a lot of structure around what these programs look like or any consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what the Society of Arts Entrepreneurships is trying to do, is come together as a group of educators and say, what would basic curriculum look like when we're teaching students how to think about starting their business?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also an exciting time as both a student and an educator to be in some of these programs and classes, because we are building them from the ground up. And that is an opportunity. That's a place to question what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how long do you think it would take until it's a standardized thing? Is it like in 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now?
Well, there's been huge shifts that I've seen from when I graduated from undergrad to what I see now.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's interesting. The thing about higher education and academia is that it's always playing a little bit of catch up with like the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of, like, for example, music curriculum. A lot of standardized music curriculum in higher education ends with jazz and misses the last like 60 or 70 years of, you know, music history. And so education is always trying to catch up. But I think it's a process.
Well, and it's tricky right now too with things like social media. I mean, it's changing every 5 minutes. And so ever since you and I chatted, everybody I talked to since then who's either just graduated or is doing their MFA now, I ask them, like, did you have a class like this? And a lot of them said yes, but they said the content depended on who taught it. So if you had a teacher who totally understands social media and was like, here's what you need to do. You need a site, you need to be on Instagram, you need to be doing this, blah, blah, blah. You'd get one kind of education. And if you had a prof who wasn't into that kind of stuff, you'd get another kind of education.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a tricky thing. Like, just even as a person, just trying to keep up with all of that stuff and know what the latest thing is and how you should be marketing yourself. And so I'm sure within the world of academia, how do you keep up with that?
And I think it happens a little bit to every generation. I remember my professors in the late 90s saying, if you wanted to be an illustrator, you had to like bound a book of your work together and walk around the streets of New York and find arts directors.
Yeah.
And then by like 2001, 2002, when I was graduating and out in the world, then it was building your website, which was a relatively new thing for artists at that time.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, it's so funny. This is totally dating me, but when I was doing, after I did my BFA, I took a year off and then went into design, and I had to decide between print design or new media, it was called at the time. And so I chose new media because I figured it was the wave of the future. And it was a 1 year intensive, and halfway we were doing CD-ROMs. And halfway through the year.
I don't even know what that is.
I know, I'm so old. Halfway through.
No, I don't want.
Halfway through the year of a 1 year program, they said, whoa, hang on a second. We're going to teach you guys this thing called websites because that's the new thing, and you need to know that. So we stopped with the CD-ROM and shifted within this 1 year program. You know, like that's how fast things were changing. It was like, oh, okay. I mean, granted, we all got jobs immediately because we were some of the few people that actually knew how to do it. But yeah, it was crazy. And I've been doing it now for like 18 years or something. Oh, whoops, I just gave away the math there. But anyway, it's one of the things that I kind of love but kind of drives me crazy is that I never feel like an expert because it's changing all the time.
Yeah, and I don't want to be down on a higher education or even teachers and the faculty that are in the doing that work because I'm one of them. But I will say that, you know, for all that was lacking in my education, there was a lot that was great, which was faculty and teachers that taught me just how to ask questions and figure things out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it would just be – this would just be the cherry on top. You know, it would just set those people up who now have their creative skills honed and, you know, kind of have had this great guidance and have been able to experiment and play and find, you know, the general direction they want to head in, and then give them this little, you know, cherry on top that just sets them out into the world.
Yeah. And I think in a way it's maybe a reflection of a fundamental shift, which is many of the art schools and arts programs were born out of conservatory models. And so there was this idea that you were a painter or you were an illustrator or you were a designer or you were this or that. And they were much more siloed. But of course, being in this postmodern world we're in, and when you look at the artists, for example, even on your blog, sometimes it's hard to define their work. Mm-hmm. Is it illustration? Is it painting? Is it something else? And when you look at the diversification that artists have on their websites when they're selling original works for a couple of thousand dollars, but then they might have smaller works for a few hundred dollars, and then they might have prints or other products.
Mm-hmm. And then sometimes they have clients that they do illustration for.
What's that?
And sometimes they have clients that they do illustration for.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool.
Hey, it's a really exciting time because we have broken down some of those silos and artists really can work in multiple forms and in different ways. And so there's a lot of opportunity for artists just to create work and maybe even make a living doing it, which is really, really awesome.
Well, it's so exciting. I think it's when you called me about this, I just thought it was so interesting and so smart. So please keep me posted on the research you guys do. And I think it's all so valuable.
I will.
So, Sydney, last thing, speed round. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. This is a Japan question. Favorite kind of sushi?
Well, I will say I became vegetarian while I was living in Japan. So originally probably shrimp tempura, but now I'll say avocado.
Okay. Fair enough. Winter or summer?
Winter.
Oh, is it really humid in the summer where you are?
It is.
Yeah, I know. That's in Toronto, I probably would have said winter too. if you were a movie character, who would you be? This is going to be some weird B movie reference that nobody knows, right?
Wow. I think I would really want to be one of the engineers in a Star Trek movie.
Oh, that would be kind of awesome. I can actually
Maybe
picture
that.
Maybe
I just want to like have access to a holodeck.
Yeah, and wear a fancy really suit. What color were their suits? Purple?
Well, okay. I'm a bit of a nerd, but it depends on which series you're talking about.
You are a nerd.
And so... the colors were really different, but if it were Next Gen, which is really the Star Trek I grew up with, that was my Next Gen. I believe the engineers were yellow.
Okay. Yellow engineer, Star Trek. Good. Final question. Yes or no? Your mother named you Sydney Pink.
No. Should I say anything else about it?
It's up to you.
Well, Well, I did choose the name Sydney Pink, and I would encourage everyone to look up Sydney Pink on Google, not me, Sydney Pink, but the other Sydney Pink, which was a artist who had a vision for what he wanted to do, which was to make movies. And he made these awesome sci-fi and monster movies. The one that really grabbed me is a movie called Reptilicus, which they find this like reptilian-like tail buried in the ice. And when they pull it up, it accidentally thaws out. And the whole creature, the dinosaur-like reptilian creature, grows, regenerates out of the tail and wreaks havoc on Copenhagen.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I chose that name in part inspired by this filmmaker that I love. But more than that, you know, I think artists have the ability to shape their world, and that's both shaping themselves on the inside, and then ultimately how you shape yourself on the inside, you take out into the world, and it's how you interact with people.
And so did it start because you started signing your name? You started signing your art like that, but you were but you had your real name, but you just signed your work like that, and then you just took it out.
But then it very much became my name. And then I think it became a symbol of this thing I'm talking about, which is that a person really can be the architect of their life, mm-hmm. and be an architect of their world, and decide who they want to be. And I don't mean by taking on a different personality. I mean going deeper and figuring out who you really are. And so in a way, taking on an artist name and then using that as my name has become a symbol of that, to say you can create the life you want for yourself.
It's very cool. When you told me that story in New York, I was just like, what? I had so many questions. What does your wife call you?
Sydney. It took her, I think, about 6 months to a year to get used to it. But she has a really interesting way of saying it. She says that my old name is who I used to be, and Sydney Pink is who I am now. And I think that's a great way to look at it. We all have different kinds of names, nicknames, yep. and different labels that we have at different points in our life. So they're all us. And Sydney Pink is just who I am today.
I love it. That is a perfect way to end. You are Sydney Pink. Thank you so much for doing this with me. You are so smart, and your light bulb moments are very insightful, and I always love talking to you. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
You are very welcome. It's been an honor.
Yay. Okay, well, we will talk soon, because I want to keep hearing what you're up to, and until then, I'll catch you online somewhere.
Sounds good.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, you thought it was over, and so did Sydney. But nope, I kept recording because that's how I roll. I love this little extra conversation that we had, so I wanted to make sure that you heard it. Ready? Here we go. It's really cool. Like, you seem very like attuned to kind of everything around you, you know, which is really inspiring because, you know, I think a lot of artists can feel really lost sometimes. Like, you know that you want to be making, but you're not sure what or why or how. And it seems...
Oh, and, well, for what it's worth, I feel lost all the time.
Do you?
I genuinely do. But I think the key is to just keep working.
Yeah.
And the other thing about that is, and, you know, one of the reasons I mentioned the Akimbo Dance Festival and sort of my various day jobs that I've had, which we, you know, I hinted at. But, you know, I think sometimes there's this perception of this, like, pure artist experience of being in the studio and inspiration hitting. And the reality for most artists is a much messier, complicated story than what you just see on their website. But it's really in all that mess and anxiety and confusion that beautiful work is made. That's mm-hmm. really where it comes out of. So I think that's part of what artists need to start to talk about, is what is really the reality of their life. On practical levels of, like, how do you pay the bills? And for some artists, that's just having a day job that may or may not be related to arts. But also how these other aspects of life are informing and guiding the art making. Because art making isn't separate from life. It's all together.
Mm-hmm. And I think when you pay attention to that, You know, I know a lot of women who have kids, I mean, their day-to-day life is taking care of their kids, but then they don't necessarily want that to influence their art because they feel like they won't be taken seriously because they're at-home moms or whatever. And it's like, yeah, but I was there. I stayed home with Charlie for 5 years. So it is so influential. And so why buck it, you know? Like, why not embrace it? And that's your reality in that time.
Yeah, and I think the thing that makes really great work is when an artist can be authentic. And I've tried to be an artist that I'm not. You know, I talked about trying to make the oil painting. You know, we all have those moments, but the more you can be the artist that you're going to be, that's when an audience is going to respond and get excited, because they're going to see something genuine. They're going to see something authentic.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to see another human being.
Yeah, who's living similar experiences to that. Like, you can relate to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're so smart.
Not at all.
Well, you sure seem like it to me. Oh, I love talking to you. I'm so glad that we finally met. And then, like, that call a couple months ago was just so interesting. And I'm so glad that you were able to do this, too.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I think people are going to get a ton out of it.
Yeah, and this will be more conversations to come, hopefully.
Yeah, oh, for sure. You're not going to be able to get rid of me now.
If you ever want to check out the Baltimore art scene, there's some pretty cool stuff happening here.
Okay, well, if I'm out that way, you're the only one I know, so I'm calling you. Okay, go eat your dinner.
Okay, I will.
And I'll let you know when if it's going up this Saturday or next Saturday.
Sounds good.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
In the messy, complicated anxiety, that's where beautiful work is made. Amen. Thank you so much to Sydney for putting off his dinner for a little bit to talk to me. Thanks to Saatchi Art for supporting the episode. And as always, thank you so much to you for listening and rating the podcast on iTunes if you feel so inclined. No pressure. I will be back next weekend with more Art for Your Ear. See you then.